The name of this session is How Questioning Parents Can Raise Thinking, Believing Children. The idea for this panel was first suggested to me by my bishop a couple of years ago when he was first entering into a crisis of faith period. It's a question that's plagued me more and more as my eldest is now entering a keener age of understanding and possible cynicism. And so I think it'll be an interesting discussion. Actually, there was a lot of discussion as to what we should even call it. It started out, can doubting parents raise believing children? And then we thought, can they be believing and thinking? Is that possible? Are we actually doubting parents, or are we questioning parents? And then it came to, should questioning parents raise believing, thinking children? And then, well, if we should, how can we raise thinking, believing children? It was just like, I mean, the discussion about just the title went on for weeks and weeks. And so and the thing that's wonderful about this, I don't think there's an answer. So those of us on our panel, obviously, are by no means experts, and we will come up with some ideas. Unfortunately, we're at a disadvantage. None of us have teenage children, which is a whole different set of problems, and so I'm hoping to learn.
We know nothing.
We hope the discussion after we present our ideas will prove to be the most stimulating part of this session. I'll introduce briefly the panelists, and they will talk more about themselves. Down at the end is John, Jonathan Hales. But he came highly recommended by friends. And it's interesting, when I was calling around, I was going, excuse me, are you a doubting parent? Would you be on a panel? And I don't know if I'm doubting. And he said he would. He was. He qualified. He said, well, I'm more questioning. Okay, good enough. We'll take it. Lorelei Davis is a friend of mine. We went to BYU together and have discussed this a lot. Her children are quite young, and she's really just preparing for this. All of a sudden, she's getting really scared about her kids growing up. And she's at this point a biology teacher and a researcher in Ohio, and she flew out just for this. Dave Brady, who's not here, but he is being read by my brother-in-law, Jordan Kimball, was my bishop and now lives in Thailand, in Bangkok. He's a lawyer there, and he emailed his paper in. I'm going to go ahead and start, if that's okay. And then afterwards, with the questions, I think that that's going to be such an important part of this session that if you direct a question to a panelist, I'd like the panelists to repeat it. If you want to come up here and present it to the room, let's make a real effort to speak into the mic as much as possible. And I may even interrupt you and ask you to come up, or I'm going to make a real effort to do that. Should I sit down or stand up? You guys are going to sit down, aren't you? I'll sit down. Okay. 2 months ago, I was sitting in Sacrament listening to a high council member relate a story of faith. This isn't on, is it? Mm-hmm. Can you hear it? Is it working? Okay. He was relating a story of faith that will seem familiar to you all. It was a story of a young family that lived in the Amazon. After their conversion to the church, they set the goal of attending the temple 1 year later. At the end of the year, they were still not financially ready to go, but because they had made the promise to God to go to the temple, they sold their business, home, truck, tools, everything so they could make the trip. They knew God would provide a way for them on their return. To survive. As I listened to the story, I remembered hearing the same story as a child and being moved by the magnitude of faith this family had, and would I ever be able to have a portion or a part of such a faith in my life? But now in my adult state of skepticism, all I could think of was that poor family returning to nothing, no job, no home. Where did they go? Did the marriage survive? Did they ever get reestablished? My thoughts were interrupted by my son's elbow. Mom, he said, that seems like a really irresponsible thing to do. Why didn't they just wait another year till they had enough money and still be able to keep everything? I wanted to explain about putting trust in God. I wanted to defend this act of faith, but I couldn't. I agreed. Yeah, it seems kind of silly, doesn't it? I was shocked by my son's realistic perspective of a story that at his age, for me, had been a beautiful fairy tale. I was raised a believing child in an Orthodox home. And all my growing up, I can't think of a Sunday where we did not attend meetings and partake of sacrament. Even when we were camping or snowed in or rarely traveling, I can remember my parents and 5 siblings preparing for a Sunday meeting. My little sister Jane would open with prayer. 2 of us would give 30-second talks. We would sing hymns, and my father and brother would pass the sacrament. The body was often represented this time by soda crackers or torn hamburger buns, and water was passed in a single cup. I learned a reverence and respect for this ritual that I cannot deny, even in my present state of ambiguity. I grew up believing in absolutes. They defined things clearly, and belief in these absolutes gave me answers to so many seemingly unanswerable questions. Some of the absolutes I grew up with were things like, only Mormons will go to heaven. Thus, baptism is a very important thing in your life. Temple marriage is the only sure way to a successful, happy marriage. The church is led by 15 unfailing men who regularly receive inspiration from God. Sex outside marriage is next to murder in its gravity. Our church has all truth. There's nothing that cannot be made better by regularly attending meetings, studying the scriptures, and prayer. America is God's favorite country. Mormons are God's favorite Americans. The Book of Mormon is more true than the Bible. If you pray hard enough, your prayers will be answered. Faith can move mountains. I need to interject here. My parents didn't snowball me with this. I remember in eighth grade my father pulling me to the side and saying, asking me if I thought I was better than anybody else because I'm a Mormon, and I thought it was a trick question because I did think I was better. Wasn't I supposed to think I was better than everybody else? And he, you know, pointed out to me, says, you know, don't ever think that. You know, it's what you are that you're judged by. And I remember that just kind of being this, you know, radical thought. Well, my dad's a radical man. And but other than that, mostly I was taught through church, and that's how I gained my belief in these absolutes. Although in retrospect, these seem somewhat naive, and if you were to confront most Mormons with these absolutes, they may even deny the statements as being simplistic. Yet the message reverberates even blatantly in Sunday school lessons and sacrament talks. I should say that I'm in a ward, though, you know, maybe I have an unfair perspective now. I'm in a very difficult ward right now who is very, very... it's a very hard ward right now. I carry a lot of bitterness, and I think generally that many of you may find argument with this. These absolutes carried me through childhood, youth, on a mission, and into adulthood. They created in me a sense of devotion, a sense of belonging and security, which I have since learned from Joseph Campbell were positive influences on my sense of self. It was my belief in the absolutes that if I was sexually active before married in the temple, I would never go to the celestial kingdom with everybody else in my family and ward. That fear of condemnation from God and the idea that someday everybody I knew was going to see a movie of my life served well to keep me from making a decision about my sexual lifestyle that may have led me to teenage pregnancy or marriage too early. Unfortunately, it also created in me a sense of body shame and gave a sexual identity discomfort that I've had to deal with as an adult. So, you know, there's obviously a price for each thing. What I'm saying is that I was glad I was raised with these beliefs. It made me feel safe, but now I question and doubt most every one of these statements. What do I say when my children begin to believe the statements that they're taught in church? How do I answer my son when he says, but Mom, it must be true, it says so in Mormon doctrine? I have decided that the organized religion can be beneficial to a child's developmental growth, so I've decided to raise them in a church familiar to me. But I wonder if I can balance the belief levels in my children with my own. I want them to feel that there are answers and they can feel safe, but I don't want them to become fanatics or believe things that I don't believe are true. If I can't raise them with the same hope and faith that my parents did me, will they feel that there are no answers, that there are no absolutes? Thank you. In my struggles, which I know will become more acute as my children become teenagers, the best I can do so far is create my own absolutes. Some of them would be things like, it is good to look for good in all people. Your actions should serve to make you like yourself more. Do good unto others. This life is heaven itself. Find your bliss. And other such teachings that prophets from many religions that have lived on this earth have taught us. Other than that, I'm not sure what to do with my religion. I think the discipline of church attendance is good, so we go. I try and get my children to recognize it is not good that women are not involved in more decision-making positions in the church, yet try not to sound so critical. In truth, I am simply trying to balance the good a strong fundamental religion can give to a person with the bad. It is a difficult and dynamic challenge. Can I do it? Well, will my children still believe in faith and hope and God? I don't know. Will it be tragic if they don't? I don't know. Do I want them to be honest, loving, kind, generous people? Yes. And that is something that I can't emphasize at home and through religion. I will admit that the stress, the constant unease and energy it takes as I constantly readjust and rethink and struggle with this reminds me once more of how painfully delightful it is to be a Mormon.
I'm going to read this this paper for Dave Brady. What level of participation in the LDS Church should parents teach their children when the parents doubt some of the fundamental tenets of the Church? Should they continue to actively participate in church activities to provide a known and convenient method of religious training for their children? Or should they stop participating and try to teach spiritual principles and values on their own? Are the interests of the children better served by staying active or dropping out? Is there a viable middle ground for doubters between full participation and total separation? A short introduction will help the reader to understand how much my life is combined with the church. My wife and I are members of the LDS Church. We're raised by active, believing parents, attended seminary, served missions, married in the temple, attended BYU and the U of U, served in various leadership positions in the church, and have an extended family culture of full church participation. While serving as a bishop a couple years ago, I and my wife, to some extent, came to doubt important parts of the restoration story as told by the church, and we both dissent from some church teachings and practices. Because of these conflicts, we can't decide whether to continue to participate in the church or not. Our primary concern is the effect participation or non-participation will have on our five young children. If we don't believe in the church, don't attend. That's the most honest and simple solution. A father of a young family lost his faith in the church, quit his professorship at BYU, and left the church. When his children were fully grown, I asked him if he thought that he had made the right decision in leaving the church. He was ambivalent. He warned me that the church institution provides great moral support to young people that is nearly impossible to replace. It provides them with quality friends. It gives them a sense of identity that is lost if they leave the church. It is a functional approach to teaching children about right and wrong. It is a significant link with the extended family and a familiar culture. Before I throw all that away, he advised, I'd better consider if I could offer my children anything as good or better. His children had grown up apart from the church institution, and I think he felt that they suffered to some degree for it. On the other hand, he also felt that his personal conviction at the time he left left him no choice but to leave the church, so he couldn't say he had made the wrong decision. He decided to leave, and although he felt his children were somewhat deprived as a result, he had to stand by what he had decided. What might be the negative and positive effects if our family completely left the church? Would our children find suitable friends? Would they get married? What kind of spouses would they select? I presume they would be non-members. Perhaps they would consider a homosexual lifestyle. Would they be more inclined to take drugs? Would they be more accepting and tolerant? Would they acquire the material values of the general society? Would they have more or less concern for spirituality? Maybe they would join another church. Would they reach for excellence? Would they someday resent our leaving the church? What would Mother's Day be like without a primary program? On and on and on. The church generally has a proven track record of helping parents to raise children to become healthy people who stay in school, stay out of trouble, and stay in marriages. It provides a certain definable sense of identity. It provides a generally positive social setting, at least for active members, that has value to us, that makes us want to stay active. Suppose we stay. Since we agree with many of the virtues taught by the church, as well as by most other churches, we could just stay active and make the best of it. Don't most active members have at least some disagreement with some of the doctrines expressed by church leaders anyway? Since the point of most church discussions is to improve our characters, we could just think of attending church as something like listening to Aesop's fables, and the moral points being more important than the truthfulness of the accounts, like a good Disney movie. Unfortunately, believing and doubting Mormons alike will appreciate the difficulty of participating in a church when we honestly feel that actually there are no golden plates, first vision, ministering angels, or literal revelations. No matter how much we believe in honesty, kindness, love, patience, courage, compassion, service, and many other LDS values, we find it difficult to be joyful in church because of our fundamental lack of belief. Our comments often invite conflict or offend others. If we sit in quiet disagreement, our hearts pound and our faces redden as we wonder why we're there. Some of our fellow members learn to distrust us and any comments we may make, no matter how orthodox or unorthodox they may be. Our children may be treated a little differently, not in any overt way, but perhaps as if they had a sick parent. Some try to lovingly reconvert us. Our family situation comes up in bishopric meetings, even when I'm in attendance as the clerk. We've been given callings designed to insulate our disbelief from the ward. We've come to be regarded as something less than we should be. Besides the personal conflict or hypocrisy we feel while attending church, our children are occasionally taught ideas that we consider false or even dangerous. We are told a highly edited story about church origins, which leaves inaccurate impressions. They're not told the whole truth about current church doctrines, ordinances, and policies. They're instructed to obey others based on the position of one giving the direction rather than the value of the direction being given. They're told that their church is superior to all others. They're told that women are not qualified to preside in the church or in the family simply because they are women. They're exposed to a system of status seeking based on church callings. They're told that science is incorrect to the extent it conflicts with religious dogmas. We do not believe in these and other teachings, whether official or unofficial, and our children are receiving them in church. In less than 2 weeks, our son will turn 12. Do we ordain him to the priesthood when we don't believe in the story of the restoration of the priesthood and believe that a male-only priesthood is morally wrong? If not, does our son then keep attending young men as a prospective deacon? If he is ordained, how do we explain our beliefs to him without deprecating his ordination? What if he wants to be ordained just to be part of the group? What if he sincerely believes? We will face these kinds of practical tangles from time to time if we stay active. What about seminary? What about missions? What about the temple? And on and on. We encounter conflicts with our consciences and our fellow ward members as we try to remain active in the church as doubters. We are in a position of teaching our children ideas that we don't believe are true. We are seen as something less than what we ought to be simply because we have made the effort to critically examine our faith. Taken all together, that makes us want to leave. Home church, a middle path. Our dilemma is somewhat similar to that faced by conservative Christians who appreciate the value of sending their children to public schools but can't tolerate the ideologies they receive or don't receive, as the case may be, from the schools. The reaction of our Christian parents has been to homeschool their children. Similarly, we have started to home church our children. We agree with the church's teachings that parents are primarily responsible for the religious training of their children. Church leaders have expressed that the church should be an appendage to the family spiritual training. We are experimenting with that idea. Perhaps we could keep our identity as nominal Mormons, but attend church at home as a family. We've only done it a few times as of the date of this essay, but so far it has been more relaxed, more interesting, and more productive, but also more isolated. It's much like a family night without the games and fooling around. We pick one of our core values and try to discuss or present it in a way that the children will understand and appreciate. We're thinking about using something like the Scout Law for our curriculum. A Scout is trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent. We will also teach about the LDS and other religions, the nature of God and man, prayer, spirituality, the big questions, sexuality, social responsibility, the Golden Rule, and any other relevant topics. This hasn't totally displaced church attendance. We use the church as a resource. We attend church when we want to go. We order Mormon ad posters and church tapes out of the church supply catalog. We receive church magazines and have access to general conference tapes. The congregation sees us as fair-weather attendees, and they're right. Most seem to feel badly about it. But some real friends at church are glad to see us and welcome us wholeheartedly each time we come. Unfortunately, what's missing from our home church is perhaps the most enjoyable part of the LDS church: open, honest, loving, joyful fellowship with the saints. No youth conferences, no choir singing, no priesthood wisecracks, no Christmas programs, no ward dinners, no correlation meetings, no gossip, no visitors, introductions, no move-ins, no move-outs, no instant friendships based primarily on church membership. For now, since we really can't bring ourselves to leave the church, we will home church when we want to stay home and visit the ward once in a while to stay in touch and fellowship. Perhaps with time, we'll discover that we are able to provide our children with most of the benefits of religion on our own. Or perhaps we'll determine that we need to plunge into church, full church participation again. Until either of those occur, we will seek in the ward or create in our home whatever religious training we can for our children, and we will struggle with the duplicity that creates.
For about 3 years of my life, every birthday candle, every falling star, every wishbone, every penny in a well, I had the exact same wish. I had a 9-month-old daughter who had a massive stroke, was paralyzed on one side, speech development stopped, and it was always the same wish. I want her to be better. I want her to be well. I want her to be on the track that I had envisioned for her life when she was first born, when she was a tiny baby in my hands. Of course, she had priesthood blessings. One time we were at the Vatican, passed within 3 feet of the Pope, who did one of these kind of things. I thought, can't hurt. Everything. This was the whole focus of my life. I don't think a moment went by when my concentration was not on her and what I wanted for her. And it became a time when I wasn't seeing it happen, the things I wanted to have happen for her and the blessings weren't working and my faith wasn't strong enough or something wasn't there and she wasn't becoming the child I had envisioned her to be, that I started questioning and doubting and getting really angry with all of the years that I had felt like I had invested into this God who wasn't doing what he was supposed to do for me. And I had kind of a vector pathway for what I expected from her life that she had gone away from. And there was a point, maybe a couple years ago, when it was, I don't know if it was birthday candle or falling star or what, where I started to make this wish, and all of a sudden I realized I was wishing for a child that wasn't my little girl. Was I wishing for somebody who hadn't gone through the years of learning to walk up and down stairs? Was I wishing for somebody who wasn't this person in my house? Was I just wishing for another child entirely? Because her pathway was now so far from what I thought it was going to be when she was a baby that she was a different person. And I've kind of taken this as I look at what I expected for myself in the church as well, that I had a vision of what direction I was going, and I did everything I should go on there, but somewhere along that route, there was something that changed my direction a little bit. And where I am now is so far from where I thought I was going to be in the church. The vectors have become so malaligned. They're not aligned with each other anymore, that I can't wish myself back to where I was. So the way that I thought I was going to raise my children in the church, I cannot do because I'm not that person I had expected myself to be. So when Kathy asked me to do this, I thought, what was it the church gave me as a child? Since I'm thinking about my own children here, what was it the church gave me that was really valuable that I want my children to have? And the two main themes I came up with, I realized were kind of two-edged swords, security and direction. The church was definitely provided a lot of security for me growing up. I remember one time when I was very small being in a museum in Germany, and there was a medieval 12th century painting on wood that showed Mary holding out a cloak, and huddled underneath her cloak were all of these cowering people. And up above her was God throwing lightning bolts down at the people, but Mary was protecting them from God. And my mother pulling me over and showing me this and said, "This is not the God that we believe in. This is not our Heavenly Father. Our Heavenly Father loves us. He was the one who'd be holding us in his arms and holding the cloak over us. She's not a person to protect us from God." I was always very secure in the idea that my Heavenly Father loved me, would listen to me, and would be there for me, provide a constant security. It became of great importance to me about 8, 9 years ago when my father-in-law died. Wonderful man, patriarch in his church, dearly beloved by the ward members in Atlanta, Georgia. But we sat as a family at his funeral. At the same time that we ached for his loss, we felt a real comfort that we knew where Chet was, and we knew we would see him again, and I felt such security. A few years later, when I was facing the same possibility with my own daughter, the security was gone. I didn't feel it anymore. I wanted to have that same assuredness, and maybe it was because the crisis was more direct at me, but I was clambering and wishing for that same security, which is no longer there for me. The real security, I think, that a religious person has, that I had as a child, is summed up in the word faith, which makes Christians unique from all other religions. We have this idea that there is this thing, this inarguable, illogical thing that just says, "I believe." And that faith was something that I didn't have access to anymore as a child. I kept up my faith for a long, long time beyond the point where it was doing me any good just wanting to believe. I mean, I was the kid who believed in Santa Claus still when I was 12 years old and was trying to think of reasons to make it be like that. I remember one time asking a CTR class that I was teaching after Wizard of Oz had been on TV the night before. I said, "So do you think she really went to Oz, or do you think it was all a dream?" And they looked at me and said, "It's a movie. What are you talking about?" But to me, it was important. She really went to Oz. I was just a person who always wanted to have faith, and I wanted to have that security there. I don't know if faith is appreciated thoroughly for the strength that it has either inside the church or outside of the church. Within the church, very often, I will have people try to explain to me that the church must be true because, could you see how quickly Joseph Smith wrote the Book of Mormon? It couldn't have been done if he'd done it on his own. The church must be true because, all those becauses can be knocked down. The only thing that will still stand is faith. As a biology teacher, I see people from outside the church doing the same kind of thing. Every time I teach evolution, the textbooks will put in a quick little thing at the beginning, going through and breaking down the reasons why there didn't have to be a divine designer for the universe and that kind of thing. And for my kids who are religious, which aren't very many of the classes I teach, I just junk that. Because if you've got a position of faith, you don't have to worry about these reasons. It's outside. It's inarguable. It's a secure comfort. The bad side of the security that I grew up with, and that I don't know what to do, how to hand it to my children, was it led to, I saw around me, people wanting to have problems solved for them. I guess you were describing somebody who's describing somebody who would else, who sold everything and go off to the temple with this faith. My mother's ward in Provo must have two or three family who's moving in every single year who've gotten a revelation that they need to do just what Stephen Covey did. And they'll come and move into somebody's basement house in Provo with 16 children and no money and nowhere to go because the Lord has told them they need to get filthy rich like Stephen Covey did or something like that. And they've taken on faith, they're going to come there. And the whole ward has to help them along and struggle through it until eventually they figure out what they're doing with their lives because they've made this move on faith. They want things to be taken care of for them. I think also that security leads to a lack of appreciation for a struggle. Something that I really enjoy is struggling through things. If I pay my tithing, the Lord will work it out. Well, sometimes I paid my tithing and the checks bounced and I lost more and more and more money and the Lord just didn't work it out for me. Instead of stopping to say, maybe I should work out my own life and figure out how much money I have and work out my finances, the idea that if I just paid my tithing, somehow I could ignore the rest of my life and not take any responsibility for it, that kind of faith I saw as being the bad side of the two-edged sword. The other thing that I really liked having as a child and that I wish I could impart to my children is direction. I remember being at girls' camp and late night around the fire after you've gone through all the testimony bearing, and we would sing, I'm a child of God, and still it brings tears to my eyes when you come to the third verse where you sing, rich blessings are in store. If I but learn to live, do his will, I'll live with him once more. And that direction of an overall picture, a place that I am going, a reason I am doing these things, gave me a reward. I don't think that I was ever taught the bad side to avoid the punishing. I think I was taught a very loving route to heaven and that these rich blessings were the reasons I was holding out and living these commandments. When something didn't make sense to me, as it did more and more through high school and college, I was able to take it and just kind of put it on a back burner and say, one, have faith, and two, think about the big picture. The bad side of this is, because there is always a bad side to these things, is that I did ignore too much. For me, the crisis came, as it has for many women of my generation, with women's issues in the church. And I kept just saying, I don't understand it, I don't know why they're doing it, just put it on the back burner. But I also felt like it didn't affect me. I chose to become a biochemist, I worked really hard through graduate school, I chose a career because I wanted to have a career, not because I had to support a family. I chose it because I wanted to do it. And I thought somehow all of the advice that they were giving about women's divine roles didn't affect me, it was okay, I would choose the right things, until the time of crisis came, when my daughter's life was in danger. My marriage was suffering terribly through all the stress of watching her go through her suffering. And all the years I had said, I can choose my path, I can do what I want to do, you look for someone to blame when your children are in crisis. And I blamed myself. I went right back to saying, I was told I shouldn't work. I was told I shouldn't choose a career. I was told that there was a divine role for women selected from above. And now my family is suffering and it is all my fault. And the hell I put myself through, believing things that I had thought I hadn't believed for years, when I finally came on the other side of that and said it's not my fault, really made me angry that I had been told these things, thought I could ignore them, and yet deep inside of me, they were tearing me apart when it came to a time of crisis. So the direction, the commandments, where you think you're heading one way and you think you can stay on that pathway, nonetheless, what you've been taught along that route is going to gnaw at you. And I don't want my daughters to be in that position where they have to be blaming themselves because of something that they thought they understood, they had made a good decision about, but what if I was wrong? And then I'm sure they'll face something like that anyway. So what I'm left with now is a difficult situation. I don't know what the big picture is. I don't know what direction I want to head my children. And because I have a hard time, I don't teach my children things I don't believe in myself. Sometimes I'm left again and again saying, I don't know. And I can't give them the two things that I got most as a child, the comfort and the direction that the church gave me, because I don't have it to give to them. Which is, in the end, what I've settled into kind of being a scientist, a kind of scientific materialism view of the world, which is explains a lot, takes care of a lot of things for me, but it's not particularly comforting. It doesn't provide direction. It doesn't have any role for faith in it. In the end, what I'm left with is still kind of questioning. My children are 4 and 7 years old. I don't have the experience that many people in this audience do. So I'm still questioning, what can I give them? All I know is what I can't give them. I can't give them what my parents gave me, which was the regular testimonies from them. I can't give them the sure knowledge that I've investigated, I've worked it out, and I know the church is true. Something that my mother still tries to give me when I get together with her and we hash these things out. They always ended her bearing her testimony to me. I can't do it for my children. So whatever path they take, it's not going to be the path I planned for them already, I know that, just as mine isn't the path that my mother planned for me. I just have to give them what I'm learning as I go as well. That's all I can say.
I'm the oldest of 10 children, and like I think everyone else who has spoken today, my parents were devout Mormons and raised us in a very Orthodox Mormon home. My mother's been Relief Society president. My dad has been a bishop, and he's now a stake president. We read scriptures at 6 a.m. Every morning growing up, and I remember liking it. My parents often said, to us that we needed to find things out for ourselves, yet I didn't see a lot of questioning or doubting around me. I felt a lot of security in that home. I felt that we were in the right place doing the right thing, and it was a comforting place to grow up. I went to Brigham Young University and majored in English. Then I went to medical school at the University of Utah, a residency in medicine at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles. Then after that, having lost my testimony in medicine, my testimony of medicine, I should say, I went to USC for a graduate program in screenwriting, and now I'm a struggling screenwriter. 9 of the 10 of us in my family, 9 of the 10 children are still faithful, believing members of the church, and I count myself 1 of the 9, yet somehow I find myself saying appalling things in Sunday school, and wondering often if there's a God and if there's life after death, or if these are just stories that we made up to comfort ourselves in the face of some horrendous fears. A lot of my comments about raising thinking, believing children will revolve around ideas of storytelling. That's kind of what I think about a lot lately, is stories and why we tell stories and how we tell them. Sarah Sandberg is my wife. She and I have 2 daughters, Eliza, who is three this week, and Margaret, who's 3 months. I'd just like to say publicly here that we named Eliza before Legacy came out. Okay? We're worried of a whole plague of them now. Also at the onset, I'd like to give the same disclaimer that everyone else has given. I know very little about belief and less about child raising. I'm speaking from the relatively unfettered position of ignorance. My mother, however, raised 10 children, and when I ask her advice about how to raise children, she gets a blank look on her face and has nothing to say. To begin with, I'd like to tell a story. Last week, I was a good dad one night, and I gave my daughter Eliza rides around the house. She was on my back. I'd crawl around on my hands and knees. Then I put her to bed. And in the middle of the night, she woke up crying and wouldn't go to sleep. I was very tired. I've been pulling night shifts in the emergency room. I've been writing as much as I could during the day. We've got a 3-month-old who wakes us up in the middle of the night. And I felt that Eliza had lost her night crying privileges a few years ago. So I shouted from my bed, "Go to sleep." And she didn't go to sleep. So I got up and walked in there and put her blanket on and, you know, laid her down, said, "Nighty-night, sweetheart," and put her down. I was out of there. Her whimpering died down for a little while, but then she started up louder than ever. and I got mad. And I went in there and told her, Eliza, go to sleep, and I put her down, and I walked out of there angry, and she stopped crying and went to sleep. Of course, I lay there feeling guilty for a while. The next morning, she woke up and told me a dream that she had, and she often does this. She often tells us her dreams. She's a vivid dreamer. And she said she dreamed about monsters, and they were mean and scared me, she said. And then I listened to her, and she sounded frightened. But then she said some nice monsters came and gave her a ride on their backs, and it was really fun. So I tell this story. It doesn't sound that relevant, but I'll bring it around, I promise. I tell this story to point out the importance of myth and dream, which I think are made of the same psychic stuff. They help us deal with events in our lives and fears and hopes. And I believe that my daughter got great emotional therapy out of the dream itself and out of telling it to me. I could have tried to give her a more correct, as I might have supposed, worldview by pointing out that there's no such thing as monsters and that those monsters are symbolic representations of your dad. But at this point in her life, I don't think that I would have that doing that would have served any purpose other than to make mundane and academic some pleasures and fears that to her were of mythic proportion. I did apologize for being so mean to her, and she forgave me. But I feel the greatest service I did to her was listening to her dream and giving her an emotional outlet and support rather than insisting on some strictly correct worldview, as if I have any handle on a strictly correct worldview. So how does this affect the issue of how a questioning parent can raise a thinking, believing child? There are many stories told within Mormon culture whose factualness or veracity are similar to that of Eliza's monster dreams. That is, their mythic, symbolic representations of hopes and fears and conflicts. So how do we approach a story that we may feel has questionable historicity or some other form of inaccuracy? The questioning parent may feel a strong tendency to want to protect a child from these in the name of truth and honesty, but I feel a too cynical of an approach can rob the child of a sense of wonder and awe for the divine and of a sense of spiritual security. On the other hand, too permissive or naive of an approach to stories encountered in Mormondom can lead to gullibility and worse, stunted spiritual growth. For the most part, I'm talking about stories that we really doubt here. One way to help our children become thinking, believing individuals, I think, involves making a distinction between myths that contain valuable meaning on one hand and infantile fantasies on the other. Joseph Campbell, in The Hero with a Thousand Faces, I'd like to refer to him also, says, "It has always been the prime function of mythology and rite," and this is really the stuff of religion, "to supply the symbols that carry the human spirit forward in counteraction to those other constant human fantasies that tend to tie it back. There are myths that help us mature, and then there are infantile fantasies." And I hope I can help my children develop the ability to tell the difference. I'll give an example of a few of each of these. For me, a myth that contains valuable meaning is the Garden of Eden story. I doubt the historicity of much of the story, but the meaning is profound. The child hearing this story experiences a symbolic representation of his or her own world and predicament. Adam and Eve, like the child, exist in innocence, in a safe paradise, and in the presence of all-knowing, loving parents. But God knows, as do the parents, that Adam and Eve and the child must leave in order to progress. This myth helps the child deal with the horrible conflict of staying in the nursery paradise versus venturing away from parents into the lone and dreary world to become independent adults. It has potent symbolism for the child's spiritual life also, regarding separation from God and the existence of evil and suffering. So it doesn't matter to me so much whether the garden was in a certain county in Missouri. What matters to me is that my child hears the story and feels its archetypal message. Another myth with meaning to me, and again, by myth I don't necessarily exclude historicity, is Lehi's vision. I took Susan Easton Black's church history course at Brigham Young University. One day she brought out a bunch of journal entries and read accounts to us of Joseph Smith's grandpa, great-grandpa, and some aunts and uncles all having the same dream that is recorded as Lehi's dream in the Book of Mormon. Turns out it was kind of a tradition in the Smith family to have dreams about trees of life, iron rods, large and spacious buildings, and mists of darkness. So when I heard this, I remember doing some mental backbending to make this information fit with my current beliefs about the Book of Mormon. And you can do it, okay? God gave the Smith family these dreams to prepare them for the time that Joseph would find the same dream on the golden plates. It's possible. But I was troubled by other explanations, less orthodox ones, that came into my mind that were equally logical or more so. It could be that Joseph Smith kind of slid this dream into the divine record on his own, an unauthorized addition. Or it could be that the whole, and that it reminded me when I thought of that, of what Hollywood producers do to our scripts. But it could be, though, also that the whole book is a collection of Smith family legend held together by King James verses. Could be many things. But the story itself is a powerful one for me. And though I'm not sure what to make of the origins of the story in the Book of Mormon, I'd hate to have grown up without the symbolic representation of life that is Lehi's dream. Working in Hollywood in particular now, that great and spacious building of great and spacious buildings, it's nice to have that story around to remind me of the fruit delicious to the soul from the tree which is the love of God, and that the word of God leads to it, and that there are mists of darkness but that I can pass through them. It helps me remember to not sell my soul. So for my children, I'll tell them that story. I believe a good story has its origins in the divine, and the twists and turns that the story takes between God's lips and our ears are less relevant to me than the truths that the story contains. And if we emphasize first to our children the truths and joys and lessons of those stories, when later our children make disturbing discoveries about their origins, they'll be less likely to throw out the principles while they grapple with historicity and other issues. Okay, now an infantile fantasy. In my mission, an elder who should have been tracting stopped and played basketball with a bunch of hoodlum kids. He broke his leg, of course. Too embarrassed to let the mission president know, he went to a faith healer, and miraculously the faith healer healed the missionary's leg. It was good as new. But the missionary found he couldn't do the work. He didn't have the spirit. Finally, he couldn't stand it any longer and went to the mission president and confessed all that had happened. The mission president gave him a blessing, and snap, the leg broke again. But the elder had the spirit now. The leg eventually healed on its own, but the elder was able to do the work now. Okay, I doubt the historicity of that story, too. I heard that on my mission. I'm sure you may have on yours. I admit the possibility, but I kind of doubt the historicity of this story. I think it's a safe example of an infantile fantasy, though, that we might encounter in our culture. It seems to say that God will punish you physically for breaking the rules, that we, as in the mission president, are better than you, the faith healer. And it seems to promote a simplistic and pat worldview rather than the mature, thoughtful view that I believe God would have us develop. I believe we do a child no good by telling stories such as this. And if unintentionally exposed, I think your child should be quickly debriefed. Another story, lights on in the temple. It seems any time a janitor works late in the temple, stories circulate in the community that the Savior has visited. I believe... And I've heard this frequently at my award that where my grandparents' ranch is in southern Utah. Do we need that much reassurance that God knows about us and loves us? I believe there are better ways to help our children feel close to God than stories like that. Then there are pithy maxims, such as if you follow your leaders and they ask you to do something wrong, the sin will be on their head. This leads to things such as Holocausts and Mountain Meadows massacres. If you do what's right, everything will be okay, maybe in the really long run. An infantile fantasy lends a child a false sense of security. This is what we've talked about a lot, is the sense of security that we may miss if we're questioning parents. But that's the wrong kind of security, the idea that we're the chosen ones, that all is well in Zion, and that if you do what's right, you won't suffer. A meaningful myth gives more lasting security by helping a child understand the world, his or her place in it, and the wonderful growth that is possible to a courageous and virtuous person. Another way to help our children develop mature belief is in the way we tell stories, how you handle them. In telling the Garden of Eden story, I believe it's better to emphasize Eve's struggle and the anguish that our heavenly parents must have felt about wanting us to be safe and unharmed, yet knowing we need to be forced out into the cruel world where there's evil and suffering. I believe we serve them less if we try to force some sort of factual historicity on the story. In church last week, a high counselor went to great lengths to explain that Adam and Eve were physiologically sterile before they partook of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. I think that's missing the point. And, you know, if we, and quizzing our children about what county the Garden of Eden was supposedly in is also missing the point. Telling a story that way could convey an idea that we'd be saved for having the right information, or that we're a chosen people because we are given the correct. Now, just a couple of quick ideas of other things we might do to help our children grow into thinking and believing adults, even if we are questioning. Number one, I think it's important to know where your children are spiritually. It's a huge part of the task. As in other freedoms and responsibilities, challenges to belief should be given out bit by bit as appropriate for the child's level of belief and understanding. How to know what is appropriate demands that you listen to your child and know them well. Number two, many of us who question still have areas of strong belief that provide safe haven for us and might for our children. A wholehearted discussion with the child about these areas of faith while postponing half-hearted discussions about areas of doubt might be an approach. My wife has a strong belief that there is a God and an afterlife. Every now and then I ask her, "Sarah, is there an afterlife?" The way she answers makes me feel better. I think I want that for my kids. I'm not sure they're ready to hear what she has to say about some other issues, though. Also, asking a child about their beliefs and helping them in their own search rather than telling them all the time about your own beliefs might be an approach. My wife typed this part in. She, don't insist on transferring your exact belief system to the child. We all see through glass darkly. Allow the child to develop his or her own beliefs and allow God to work with the child without your screwing things up. Four, recognize that there's a risk in being a questioning parent. My good friend Dan is a good example of this. His parents were devout Mormons, yet they wanted their 11 children to be independent thinkers, not conformists. They encouraged their kids not to cave into peer pressure, encouraged them to question, explore, and be different. These kids turned out to be McKay, Smith, Lee, and Kimball scholars. And interestingly, five of the 11, including Dan, now consider themselves gay. Dan told me, with a twinkle in his eye, that his mom and dad now wished they had urged their children to, you know, try to fit in and be more like the other kids. Let me make it clear that I don't claim any connection between the parents' child-raising methods and their children's ultimate sexuality. It should take a well-designed survey, I think, also to demonstrate what effect, if any, parents' encouragement to question actually has on a child's belief system. But it does seem that we take a risk in being questioning parents. By being a questioning parent, you are in essence allowing your child to eat of the forbidden fruit of knowledge of good and evil, and that means you are banishing them from paradise. The upside of this is that that's their only chance of leaving their infantile state and growing up into independent adults. Humility and disbelief. I sometimes feel irritated by those in the church who are so darn sure of themselves and who know something is a certain way, and I want to see a little bit more humility from them. Yet there's room for my side for humility on my side too. I should have humility in my disbelief and recognize that I could be wrong. The earth could have been created in 7 of our days. Adam and Eve could have been physiologically sterile. I suppose it's possible. Self-certain doubting can be just as dogmatic and just as resistant to clear-minded analysis as self-certain belief. And in dealing with my children, it's important early on to let them see that I'm not sure of a lot of things and that there are more things in heaven and earth that are dreamt of in my philosophy. Forgive me for butchering that. Lastly, and please don't take this as the take-home message, send them to primary, go out for donuts, and hope for the best.
Excellent. I think we even got some answers there. I didn't think there'd be any. Let's table some discussion. Any thoughts? Yeah.
It's a question actually that's come up on an internet list.
And why don't you come up here? It sounds like more than one sentence. So.
This is actually a question that's come up on an internet list that I'm on with several other individuals. And it's a question, actually, that I've started laying the groundwork for with a 6.5-year-old daughter of mine. And that is, how do we know, and I'd like to see this addressed by all of you, and maybe you can kind of suppose what he would say since he isn't here. How would you know when an 8-year-old is genuinely ready to be baptized into the church rather than just this having be an automatic rote ritual process they go through? What is it that we can reasonably expect an 8-year-old to understand of the commitment they're making when they're baptized And is it is when would it be appropriate to postpone a baptism?
Before my children were 8, I had decided they wouldn't be baptized when they were 8, that it was just too big of a step for an 8-year-old to make. And then what I did is I just had reread Power of Myth the year before my first son was baptized. And I can't believe the change that made in me. What I came to terms with is I decided that I would rejoice in baptism as a ritual, that my child would go through that that helps him join a club. You know, he's now a member of this club. I didn't look at it as, okay, his sins are washed away. He is now, you know, pure before God. And if he does anything wrong, now he has to go through the repentance process. I didn't look at it as that. I looked at it as this public recognition of a child becoming 8, going through a step, going through a process, that one of many that he'll go through in his life. And we actually made a really big deal about it. My last son, we drove all the way up to Montana, and several members of my family drove all the way up. He was baptized in a beautiful river. It was a large ceremony. There were gifts. We had a program. We had music. And, you know, up until then, I always thought I would just kind of poo-poo this ceremony as this small little thing, and we made a really big deal of it. And I think that was very good for him. He got a lot of attention. It was, I tried to see it as, this is an important ritual, and I think ritual is an essential part of their growth. Was he ready for baptism? What do you mean? I don't know. How can you ever be ready I'm not ready for baptism. You know, it's like, so I think that I emphasized it for what I felt the good it served, and that was, this is a wonderful ceremony to present you to, you know, your ward, and, you know, this is a public declaration I want to be part of this society, and I'm joining, I'm conforming, and that's okay. Some confirmation is okay. And so it ended up being a really big deal. You might have different thoughts about that. That's just what I, because until then I had this, oh, they're going to wait. Maybe when they're 10 or 11 or 15, they get baptized. When it came right down to it, it was an important thing for them to do with all their class members.
This is where Kathy and I always end up parting, is that for me, I don't like, I'm not fond of ritual in general. I was always, always uncomfortable in the temple with the ritual. And somehow, I think I got tricked into it, because I remember growing up in Sunday school classes and my teacher saying, you know, those Catholics have all this ritual and all these prayers that don't mean anything. We don't have this in our church. It was like a slap in the face. Heck, we don't have it. We've got lots of it. And I was never very comfortable with it. And it may be because, you know, the difference between science people and humanities people, I don't know. But I don't like... I don't know what I will do with my kids, and that is I like that story. That's a beautiful story of what you've decided to do. I don't like things that don't serve a purpose directly, where what you're doing doesn't actually contribute to what you want to get as a final result from it. So going, I had to take the church kind of hook, line, and sinker, or not at all. It has to be a divinely declared ritual, which we have to go through for salvation, as a commandment, which really means something. It can't be joining a club for me. It can't be. The church has got to be Christ's church on the earth, and not a club, and not a place with a lot of good stories, or not a church at all. I've got to have one or the other. And I can't have it be a beautiful thing with enriching stories and powerful meanings behind it, unless it means what it purports to mean.
You need to be more romantic. I've got to get it.
Yeah.
I have just one thought about that. When we blessed my daughter Eliza, we thought Sarah's father would be able to stand in the circle, and at the last minute, the bishop stepped in and put an end to that nonsense, and it was one of the most horrible experiences of my life. And because of that, I think because of just my conflict and pain over that, we haven't blessed Margaret yet. Now, the reason I bring that up is I think it's just my own struggle that is keeping us from doing that, although I think it might be a very wonderful and a nice thing for Margaret. So my one comment would be, as much as possible, to try and divorce our own thoughts about the issue from how right it is for the child at that moment.
Let me interject really quick. When it comes to ritual in my church, I find that I let the ritual serve me. In blessing our children, we've never blessed any of our children in church, and I've been in included in the circle every time. We've created our own ritual with family, friends, neighbors in our home, and it's been more of a celebration. And so we've made that to serve us, and that's worked out well. Okay, yeah. If it's more than one sentence, please come up.
I have a snotty comment and then a very sincere question, if I could do both. When I see people getting too caught up in historicity, it sometimes bothers me. I don't think we have a fair standard. You've been a medical student, is that correct? I always picture the medical student coming home to his wife and saying, you know, I learned that love is really just psychological complex longings, and sex is nothing but nerve endings, and to be true to myself, I can't ever say I love you or be with you ever again. I don't know. I think we hold the church to a higher standard than in any other area of our life sometimes. That bothers me. The sincere question is, we do have teenagers. And one moved out of the home last week. And the reason was, well, she came up to us last fall and said, oh, guess what I learned in seminar today? Our seminar teacher told us that if you marry out of the temple, you're a prostitute. But we dealt with that. That wasn't the problem. I mean, we said, yeah, there's loonies in the church. I mean, we've never been that. My father went to seminary at 45 years old for 4 years at 6 in the morning, and he was a 20-year dry Mormon. So we never had real faithful kind of example. We were always very reasonable, and we could handle the loonies. A couple weeks ago, her best friend had an abortion, and she went to her best friend and said, you can't do this. It's wrong. Since then, she said she felt totally ostracized. Everybody else in school, all of her old friends, have just said, how can you tell people how to live? We went to our bishop, and he said, it's amazing how many young women I interview that feel so totally all alone in this atmosphere. They're student body presidents, they're concert pianists, they're leads in the student play, they're cheerleaders. And they feel like they're fighting the battle completely alone. So she asked if she could move to Mesa to be with her cousins and be surrounded by a lot of Mormons. And we did this on a temporary basis. We haven't made a permanent decision. It's very painful. But I don't know if it's the church that's the problem or it's the world that's the problem. I don't know. Toss that out.
I don't know about you guys, but I'm just dreading teenage years. And I hear that story, and I just go, oh, my gosh, in 10 years, I don't know if I could give this panel. Do you want to comment, anybody?
I have no skills for that sort of situation I can see now, and not really anything to say.
I'm sorry. We can't help you. Can anybody help this poor man? Let me get Terry and then come on up, please. See, we're not experts. We admit it.
I don't know what. I feel very empathetic towards this man. I've raised 4 children. My youngest is 17, and she's struggling with the same types of things, trying to be good and yet trying to also be accepted. All my kids have turned out really well. But I really appreciate your comments because I feel like you really nailed it for me. A lot of the things that I feel like I've done, you sort of said. But with kids leaving because of the situation, sometimes that's just what you have to do. You just have to not look back too much on what your parents did because situations are different now. You just have to go with what's best for the child, same with baptism or blessing of the children. And they make some of the decisions themselves, but you can still stay close to your children and give them what's... I had to send one of my children away after my husband died. He was 12, my third child, and he was rebelling in a major way, so that to the point where I could not control anything he was doing. And so I ended up sending him to his uncles, my husband's 2 brothers, and they kept him for a little less than a year. And it wasn't the ideal situation. It's never sometimes the best thing to send your child away, but it really was the best thing for him. They helped him. They got him back into school, got him a driver's license, which I had refused to do after he wrecked several cars. And you know, now he's 19 and he's on the right path and he's doing really well. But it was just a decision that had to be made at the time for that situation. So that's what you have to do.
Thanks, Terry. Okay, the woman in green.
Yeah.
Is she going to come up? Okay.
What was the man's name that just shared?
Chris.
Chris. I really appreciated everything you had to say. My heart really goes out to you. I have a lot of questions, and maybe if you can't answer them, the audience could. Just, it's been good to be here today and to hear people, in a sense, doubting in a way and questioning. That's been really good for me. Being in the Mormon Church for 10 years, I'm seeing that I have a lot of questions, and perhaps I'm the child that you all are analyzing and talking about. Someone once said that you can't lead a person farther than you're willing to go. So I question, I guess, the fact of questioning where your children stand spiritually, when perhaps maybe we don't know where we stand spiritually. For being a Mormon for 10 years, you always hear when people bear their testimony and say, yeah, I know this church is true. A lot of us want God in our lives. We want the God of love. And we look at Mormonism and we see the doctrines that perhaps aren't true. And just the first vision and the change in revelation, and you see all this and you just kind of set it aside. I guess my question is this, and perhaps a little fearful in asking it. As I said, being a Mormon for 10 years, what if Mormonism isn't true? What do you do with that? What if we live our whole lives trying to get to heaven, and when we die, we don't get there? How can we lead our children to a place that we haven't gone?
I've just got one quick thought on that. What if Mormonism isn't true? Somehow that isn't as frightening to me as it used to be, because if I believe in God, and I do, I believe that God does not want us to believe anything that is not true. He wants the best for us, and so my belief in God sort of tempers my fear in that. And for my children, too, I want to convey to them the idea that you don't need to be afraid of questioning things, because what you should be afraid of is not knowing, and not questioning often means not knowing, and God wants us to get to the truth. Regarding what if we don't get to heaven from what we're doing? I don't have as much to say about that, but a constant struggle is going to serve us the best, I believe.
Okay.
True. Yeah. Historicity and other things notwithstanding.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. I wish that would have gotten on the tape. I agree. For me, it's not an issue of whether it wouldn't be earth-shattering if someone, you know, if I knew for sure Joseph Smith didn't receive the place. That doesn't matter to me anymore. That isn't the issue. If my church isn't true, no church is completely true. And what we do is we just find the best we can from everything and make the best of it. I don't think any organization that we belong to is going to have things that hurt us and bother us and aren't completely thing. What I think we need to do is embrace, find what is good, use it to the best we can, and use what's good from everything that you can find, and you make it your own. And so that's not even an issue for me. I think it's just believing in something. Go ahead. You obviously want to add one.
I just want to appreciate, just tell you how much I appreciate just hearing, like, feedback. I'm not going to get up here today and lie to you at all. I am a Christian, and coming out of Mormonism for 10 years and searching and studying Mormonism, but mainly studying God's Word, there is something better. And Jesus said, I'm the truth, and it's not in a system, and it's not in a religion, and it's not in a church. It's in a person, and God is amazing, and he's amazing when you surrender your life to him and ask him into your life, and you know him. Thanks.
Thank you very much. You want to come up, or
sure.
Is it one line? And I'll yeah, no one-liners. That's great.
Well, I'm here as a product of believing and thinking and questioning parents. And so I guess I want to reassure all of you. I grew up in a very unusual circumstance. My family lived overseas, and not just overseas. We lived in places like Ankara, Turkey, and Baghdad, Iraq, and places where there was a lot going on that questioned your belief system and your value system. I grew up in an environment very comfortable with the idea that you agree to disagree about things. I went to BYU and discovered that I had all the skills of being a Mormon on my own and none of the skills of being a Mormon among them. And so I decided to stick out my time there. Was told you couldn't be pro-Arab and be a good Mormon. But I had dining room conversation with a family where we were all searching for the same thing. And I think we have to come to that. We're all searching for the same thing. We're not diametrically opposed to what our children are looking for. We're all looking for the same thing. And you have to have a little faith in our ability to find the truth. I remember when my family was in Washington, D.C., and we were moving back overseas, and my dad got up and he quoted Khalil Gibran, "Your children are not your children. They come through you but not from you." And I really gained a respect for my father and realized that that's exactly how they were raising us. I think you have to show your children the respect that you would show any other individual and not tamper with them too much and not project your own doubts or your own beliefs too much on them. But I now am very comfortable with the idea when I go to church and people say something that I don't agree with. My life experience prepared me for life in the church today. I can say what I feel in a Relief Society lesson or in a Sunday school and not feel ostracized from the group. And if you promote that in your home, then you're fostering an identity and a belief in your children that will give them the strength that I believe they need to exist in the church today.
I grew up truly believing in Judaism, truly believing in Lutheranism, truly believing in Christian Science, and now I truly believe in Mormonism. I've been through all those paths, and I will not criticize myself because at a different period of time in my life, I believed something else. And I would not require of my children that they believe what I believe now. I truly believe in Mormonism. 10 years later, I may not. And I will take my children to church, and I will have them taught. And if we change our mind later on, that's just fine. Life is not lived without losses. I have 4 children, one of which is probably damned. He became part of the drug culture. Well, right now, he is making his way out of it, but I may lose him. You have to learn to live with losses. That's life. And we cannot impose upon our children what exactly we believe now, and we cannot say that it is not true. I will not disrespect myself for what I used to believe. Thank you.
That's a good point, and one thing I want to say that's something I'm trying to do is prepare myself for whatever path my children may go on. And I've decided, Laurel and I decided the other night, my biggest fear is that they might be Rush Limbites. You know, that terrifies me more than them leaving the church. And so I think there are other things they could do that would frighten me more than if they decided not to be Orthodox Mormons. And so if I just go on the assumption that, like, if they just turn out happy and healthy, you know, I'm doing okay, and I don't think I'll be really disappointed if they don't embrace everything I did. Just that they're good people. Go ahead.
I just want to try to weave together a couple things that other people said for a second and give. I don't have any kids, but they do let me teach the 16, 17-year-old Sunday school class in my ward. And so I have the issue of how to teach Sunday school with the series of questions I have. And what Chris's comments brought up for me was, you know, I felt in my belief system and my way of being a kid really isolated, not probably as isolated as your kid feels, and it didn't come as big a shock as it did to her. But what this reminds me, the one thing that hasn't been said really clearly today, and I thank the woman who left the church for bringing it up, is that that in addition to helping kids cope with the fine details of how to think about historicity or Joseph Smith or church authority or whatever it is, that there has to be some really positive thing. It seems to me, all this is lead up to say, the thing that I got to have a little bit of as a kid feeling as isolated as I did was some sense that I had access to God, that there was something, some place for the answers that I would go, that in a relationship with Christ or in my spirituality, that I would come up with at least the support, if not the answers. The sense of spiritual security came not from having all the answers, okay, because I knew from a really young age, for some reason I've always asked all these questions, but the security came from some kind of a relationship and a sense of God's presence. And that seems to me to help our kids have that faith, if we possibly can, is the greatest gift we can give to them. And it's where I take my kids in Sunday school all the time, is back to the what Christ would say instead of what Brigham Young would say or something like that. And I found a lot of strength in doing that, and the kids have really, really appreciated it. They've really valued finding in the scriptures and in the Lord some of what they missed they were losing in the precision of all the answers they'd always had before that.
I wanted to go back a little bit to the teenager question. We have sort of a different thing in our house where our oldest son is 10 years older than my oldest daughter. There's no children in between. And our son, has done the right thing. You know, he's went on a mission. He's a seminary graduate, went on a mission, married in the temple. We're very proud of him. And he's he and his wife are active in their ward. My older daughter, who's just turned 17, has a very different, she kicks against the pricks. She's very challenging for us and has lots and lots of questions. And sometimes I find it's not particularly easy to try to answer questions I don't have answers for, or things that I have only know the questions and I don't know the answers. But we deal with a lot of different things. We have somebody mentioned they had a difficult ward. I don't remember who it was. And I feel like we have a difficult ward. At least it's difficult for our family. When I was talking to my wife before we came down here, I said, "What are you going to do while I'm gone?" And she says, "Well, we'll do something really fun so that you'll be sorry you missed it." And I reminded her that the young women's broadcast was this evening. And my wife is far more orthodox than I. And she said, "Why would I want to take them to go and hear that? You know, why do I want to take them and have them come away and feel like they're demeaned or second class? I don't have any question really, and I don't have any answers really, but our daughter's seminary teacher, we've been we had lots of discussions with her this year. I'm very sure that she thinks that we're at the height of apostasy. What we try to do is support our daughters. Our son is gone. Is to support our daughters in their struggles with trying to find out how they fit in into the church. My daughters go to their Sunday meetings, but they won't go to Young Women's on Wednesday night. They won't go anymore, and we're not going to make them go. That's their choice. My daughters stand up to the seminary teacher when she says interesting things, and I'm proud of them for that. I don't know exactly what we did to get them that way, but we've always tried to encourage them to think for themselves, and we've talked to them about what we thought was important. We talked to them about how to treat other people right and to treat people the way that they wanted to be treated, and to stand up for themselves. And So far, it seems to be working. I consider myself active. I consider myself a very moderate person religiously. I don't know if Oren left. He was the first guy who talked, and we're on several of the same email groups together. I don't know. I don't know what I want. What I'm trying to tell you exactly, but it's very difficult for me raising girls, you know, daughters in the church right now. We have a relatively new bishop, and when he was sustained, he was released as the young men's president, and he got up and he talked about how he's relatively young, and he's talking about how when he was in the young men's program, and he made a comment that, you know, he wondered how these young men would be, in 15 years. Now, I know what he was talking about. He'd just been released as a young men president. That's what he was thinking about. But my daughter poked me and said, the young women in our ward are going to be somewhere in 15 years, too. And, I don't know what to tell her about that other than to acknowledge that she's absolutely right. And I tried to explain to her that I was sure that the bishop was thinking about having just been released as the young men's president, that kind of thing. But it doesn't always work very well. I don't know. I don't know if anyone has any comments on that.
Look, all the women do.
it is really hard. It is the issue for women in the church is still painful. I think will continue to be painful for a long time. I really thought that I was immune to that because my parents supported me too. My parents supported me in all of my education goals. They every time the pamphlets would come out on the latest string of books called Women with 12 Men's Names Below It, my parents would kind of laugh about it with me and put it through. So I really felt support for the way that I felt, that they didn't back that kind of thing up. But maybe I'm unique in this, but when it came to times of crisis, that's when I started questioning, again, the security that I had that I was right. Because if you really want to believe in the church, the farther you get into it, the more you get into temple ceremonies, I'm sorry, women are second-class citizens all the way up through every part of it, if citizens at all. We don't have access to God in the temple. We have access through our husbands to God. We have to cover our faces. I'm sorry if I insult people about talking about the temple. There are things that just made me immediately feel this block between me and my God because I was a woman. And when my daughter was sick and I thought she was dying, I believed thoroughly in God, and I believed thoroughly in the God I had been taught my whole life, and I just decided he was a jerk, and I hated him. My husband could laugh about this because he didn't have the same kind of pain that I did with it. He'd say, well, you got to assume if there's a God, he's at least as nice as you are. He's at least as smart as you are, so you can just reject all this stuff, which I had been able to do for a long, long period of time until I came around to questioning, did I get myself in this position by being disobedient to the way I was raised to be? And if you're going to be taught all the way through primary, all the way through young women's, all the way through seminary, that there is a divinely appointed role for women, and you choose to turn your back on it, some point in your life you're going to wonder when things are going wrong, did I turn my back on something that has ruined my family's life? And they're going to be taught it year after year. And you can say, no, we don't really believe that, but they will always have to turn around and question themselves, was I right to not believe it?
I wanted to comment and make a statement on empathy for your daughter. I started going through this painful feeling of rejection by my own ward about 3 or 4 years ago, and I'm 40, and I have a family, and I'm very secure, and I have a wonderful husband, and I have a great support group in my own family in Sunstone, and I have a place to go. And I can't imagine having to go through this, but it's been painful nonetheless. You know, I, too, am, you know, very labeled in my ward, and my comments are often discounted immediately as soon as my mouth is open. And I can't imagine having to go through that at 17. You know, at 17, the church should serve a 17-year-old well. She should feel that there is a place that she can go where she is loved and embraced. That's what 17-year-olds need. If my ward doesn't give this to me right now, it's painful, but I have other places to get it. 17-year-olds, you know, it's too bad that the church can't serve her better right now. I hate to see her go through this young. Yes. Oh, good. Come on up. You can be next. Stand.
Sorry. Hi, my name is Faye Yee from Anaheim 10th Ward. I'm not sure where I'm going to go with this because my mind, I think, as all of you, in hearing all this input, my mind is going in many directions. Number one, we have three children. One is 23, returned from missionary as being a missionary in Guam. He's at UCSD studying bioengineering. I have a daughter who's at Scripps College in Claremont, highly labeled as Women Lib, that particular college. And she's planning to go to Nepal to study abroad next year. I have a 17-year-old who is into football, track, and in leadership for the school. I have enjoyed every single second of raising these three children. I am personally a education consultant. I have my master's degree in special education, specializing in gifted education. As I sit here listening, I'm reminded of being in a forum with the children. You are highly gifted, and many things in common about the same things everyone's saying. The idea of questioning is innate in gifted children. And when I work with little children from the age of 4 to high school, and children who are brought up in the church and in my own ward, I'm presently Relief Society president for 4 months, and I'm totally, you know, out of my comfort zone. But anyway, to question is part of being an intellectual human being. It's part of living on this earth. And to live in a state of inner chaos and to feel comfortable in that position, to me, is a skill. And when I hear the other things happening in the wards where people are being ostracized for their questions, it is because in our wards, we have many, is a population of great diversity. Not one person is the same. It doesn't matter our education, our racial background, or whatever. It's just a population of great diversity. And in this population, there is very little known in the wards and in our church in general of the human mind and the thinking process. So it's not so much they're against your children and their questions. It's just because they do not understand what intellect is or the idea of what intelligence is. We ourselves, some of you are involved with the programs at UCI, with the brain's research. We have know very little of what intellect is. So I think we're taking things a little too seriously here. We need to, like, loosen up. Because we have something good. I have lived my whole life looking for what I have. And I would give up everything I have to stand up for what I know is to be true. I know there is a God. I know that He loves me. And I know that through all the experiences I've had, I could write a book, has brought me to this time in my life and to brought me maybe into this room. Mormonism, quote, I don't know exactly what that means. All I know is that my life, I have been looking for a direction. I know the Buddhist religion. I've been to every church under the sun, not because of my choice. But I know that the truth lies here. And to live in a place where you can live in that inner conflict in yourself and to go straight forward to a position where you want to be, you know, that's the hard part. You're never going to find all the answers. I don't have any answers for you. I just wanted to express how I felt.
I wish she was my Relief Study president. I find a lot more peace on Sundays.
Go ahead, please.
Thank you.
I think you folks are maybe a lot more more questioning than I am. I think you're maybe you're a bit. I think your original talk about how to label this. I think you're more than questioning. It seems to me that it's not a bad thing to be questioning, but it also seems to me that you folks talk more about your losses than you did about the concern for your children's welfare. I'm certain that your concern is there and it's valid, but you all talked about your losses, and now it seems to me you're trying to find a way to give your children something that you've lost, and I don't see how you can do that without leaping into the faith.
It's a really good point. I was trying to explain to my born-again neighbor about this depression I went through, and I said, you know, we talk a lot about what it's like to lose a child, lose a spouse. So, you know, what's it like when you lose a God? And, you know, that's the type of depression you go through, and it's a loss that's so great. It is all-consuming for a long time. Coming to terms with that is a very painful thing. And it does consume you. Okay, it's time to go. I thank the panel. It was very interesting. I learned a lot. It was great. Thank you for your comments.